Welcome to weekday, hour two of our countdown of 2012. We are counting off this new year by playing some of the greatest hits chronologically of the interviews that we did and the stories that we were telling this year, 2012. We brought you up to June in the last hour, so let's go to the start of July, where the Seattle Times endorsed Rob McKenna for governor. The Charter School Initiative almost had enough signatures to make the ballot by that time, and Seattle residents were wondering if summer was bringing with it a surge of random gun violence. But much of the buzz was focused on investment fund manager Chris Hansen and the basketball arena he wanted to build in the Soto neighborhood. He made his case for a new arena on weekday.
People who have an opportunity to give back choose to do it in ways that they're passionate about. And, you know, in this case, if I can do something and make a difference in the community and it's also something I enjoy, like, you know, basketball, then that's, you know, I think is a great opportunity.
But why basketball? Why not opera or a video game arcade or healthcare?
I mean, I think you guys have a little bit of my background of where I grew up. You know, I have very fond memories of, you know, being a kid and, you know, from the police driving around and handing out Sonic cards and us chasing the police cars down, trying to get our Lonnie Shelton and Freddie Brown cards to, you know, them coming to our schools and into our communities and speak to us about different things. And I think one of the things that's underappreciated in that is, you know, there's a lot of different things you can do for youth, things like A Plus does or, you know, Children's Home Society does. I mean, there's a lot of different youth organizations out there that try to help underprivileged youth. But if I was to walk in to a classroom with Gary Payton or Sean Kemp, the actual impact that I would be able to have is on a far different level than just Chris Hansen coming in and talking. And I think that gets easily dismissed.
Yeah, well, it's an intangible, yes?
It is. And, you know, if you can craft your organization, I'll say it again. I don't pretend to be an expert on evaluating NBA talent or, you know, I wouldn't be the one sitting there in the draft and trying to encourage a general manager or coach of which player to draft. But could I set a certain amount of ethical standards and be a mentor towards the young kids of giving back to the community? That's where I think I could have an impact.
But of course, it's the game that you're bringing, right? This is about the game itself. So what do you get from the game itself, watching the game, being part of the game?
I mean, art is in the eye of the beholder, right?
Yeah, and
I mean,
so
I
for
think,
you.
I think it's a beautiful sport. You know, I think you, in the NBA, you have some of the chance to watch what I believe are the best athletes in the world perform. They've spent, you know, most of their lives dedicated to their profession, you know, overcome great odds to get to where they are. There's certainly some that take that for granted, but there's many others that are very passionate about it. And, you know, I think if you have the chance to see, you know, a Ray Allen jump shot or a LeBron James dunk, I mean, is there any question? It's an amazing feat.
Arena booster Chris Hansen talking about the basketball arena he wants to build in the Soto neighborhood and the basketball game he loves. One of the big stories of 2012, we're counting down the big stories of this year by doing a little Casey Kasem chronological countdown of the big stories and the small stories that we covered in 2012. By the end of July, as the region considered the possible return of the Sonics or basketball, the Mariners traded Ichiro to the Yankees. And we lost our favorite clown, J.P. Patches, who passed away July 22nd. The Aurora, Colorado shooter had people again calling for better gun control as the international media turned its attention to the start of the Olympics in Britain. In this busy month, we still found time to sit down with jazz piano legend Ramsey Lewis, who's still touring at the age of 76.
At 4 years old, music was not on my mind, much less the piano.
Your parents just said, get cracking?
My parents said my oldest sister was going to take lessons, and I said, I want to go too, because I thought she's going for ice cream or going to a movie or whatever. Whatever she's going to do, I want to do. They said, we can only afford one lesson right now. But I made too much noise and kicked on the wall. They said, okay. And they said, you can go with Lucille. Her lessons start next Monday. And I went, and after a couple of weeks, when Ernestine Bruce, the neighborhood piano teacher, said, Ramsey, you didn't practice. I said, practice? What's practice? You come for a lesson once a week. You tell all of your friends and you raise the noise. Hey, I take piano lessons. He says, no, you got to practice. It's at that moment I asked my parents, could I stop? Because I don't have time to practice. I got to play baseball, you know, whatever you do at 4 or 5 years old. My dad and my parents said, no. You want this. You start something, you're going to finish. And so my dad, every day, he'd come home and ask my mother, did he practice? And if she said no, I'd have a little trouble on my hands. I'm glad that happened because I must have been fairly good. By 9 years old, my dad said, you're going to start playing for our gospel choir at church.
Really?
Now, hello, you don't play for gospel choir in an African-American church unless you kind of got something together. I didn't look at it that way at 9 years old. I just knew that's something my dad said to do. And it was okay. I did it. And then a few Sundays went by, and he said, why don't you join Elnora Carter? She was our church organist. She played for the whole service. And see if you can follow her through the service, not just for the choir, but play. And so I did that. And it was after service, I'm 15, 16 years old. Now we're at another church. Dad has moved on to another church, but he took me with him. Same situation. He's conducting the choir. I'm playing for church. And Wallace Burton was the other musician who played for the whole service. After service one Sunday, he said, Ramsey, yeah, we've got this band. Yeah? Yeah, they're all in college. I'm still in high school. And our piano player is going to go with Sarah Vaughn. She heard him play. And she's going to, and he wants her to, he's leaving next week. Can you come play? Now, what I missed here is their piano player is going to go with Sarah Vaughan, okay? That's how good he is. I've never played jazz in my life. Wallace Burton, because he heard me play classical music, heard me play gospel music, he's thinking, you can do whatever. He says, show up at this place next Friday. I showed up, and he said, okay, we're going to take the bandstand. And we took the bandstand. I don't know what we're going to play. He said, we'll play something easy. We'll play a Charlie Parker song. It's based on the blues, 12-bar blues. Every jazz musician knows how to play 12-bar blues. Ramsey, you start. It's in B flat. Here's the tempo. 1, 2. And I sit there. Actually, I broke out in the boogie-woogie. Because Dad had brought home a record and some music to the boogie-woogie based on the blues. And Wallace, I mean, he almost went through the ceiling. Charlie Parker and Boogie Woogie, I don't think so. I'm trying to shorten the story. But Wallace took over on piano, and he said, listen, come over to my house tomorrow. I'll show you a few things. Had Wallace Burton not told me to do that, if he could have said, go home, you know, I'll see you in church Sunday, if he had not had me come over the next day and show me, which he did, we wouldn't be sitting here today.
The great musician Ramsey Lewis, he was our guest in July. August, of course, was time for political conventions. Political campaigning was in full swing, and there were debates over the U.S. debt ceiling. A lot of heat. But we turned our attention to another musical legend during that month as well, the blues guitarist Buddy Guy. He came up playing with Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Coco Taylor. He told us that in those early days of playing the blues, people expected the musicians to be drunk.
I first went to Germany, and they was criticizing me for not being drunk because I had all of the Roosevelt Sykes, John Lee Hooker was drinking, Big Mama Thorne, all of them. And they had me in charge of getting them out to bed in the morning to catch the bus. And the news reporters was like, who are you? You're not even old enough to play blues, you know. But I was sober, and they wasn't ready for that. But they finally figured out that wasn't the way to go anyway. But all of the old blues cats, and a lot of people don't know, that was their pay.
Liquor.
Well, you had to get drunk, and if you played well enough, you got a good-looking woman, and that was pay for that night.
Well, I don't know if we want to keep that aspect of the blues alive, do we?
Well, you can't eat that when you get hungry. You know, a lot of people look at you because you are entertaining and got a little success that you don't have to eat. A lot of musicians I know personally felt like that I'm such a great guy. I don't have to sleep. I don't have to drink. That's when they was using all these kind of drugs and stuff. I don't know how I escaped it, but I did. Because my mom used to have a broomstick, and she didn't use it to sweep after the straws went off. And she kept that to hit me with if I didn't go to bed when I got tired.
How did you escape it, do you think? I mean, you talked about, you encountered Janis Joplin. Jimi Hendrix wanted to record you so that he could study your licks. Litter Walter, I mean, all these guys did not escape what happened with drugs. And yet you were of that generation, but you did.
I remember that broomstick.
You did. That's it. It really was.
Well, no, I saw. You know, I Matter of fact, Jerry Garcia, we were playing in Berkeley, and he told me that he had some I could smoke and I would play something I never heard before. And I went around the back of the club with him, and he lit up, and I thought it was a regular cigarette, and I inhaled that thing, and I came back in. And
wait, you didn't know it was pot?
No. Eric Clapton was there, and all of them was coming to see me. This was 1969. And I went to the stage, and I don't remember what I was playing. And he saw me, called me the next day, said, man, you play some stuff you never heard. I said, you like the record? Damn right I did, because...
Yeah, you didn't hear it.
I don't remember nothing, man. So I said, it's no fun to me to play something that I can't enjoy and watch the faces of the fans or the people come to see me enjoying or clapping their hands or screaming or something like that. I want to know what's going on. And I saw if you too drunk, you sick, and if you out of your mind, you don't know what's going on. So I just kept that in mind and say, know what you did last night, buddy, so you can hopefully do that again tomorrow.
Those are words to live by. Buddy Guy, great musician. We are counting down some of the hits of 2012 that we got to share on Weekday. Another way of looking at the news of the year, counting down some of the big stories of the year by taking a look at the big stories and the other stories that were important to all of us throughout 2012. August was a hot month. Temperatures were in the 90s on the day that Buddy Guy joined us. You heard from him just before the break. Wildfires were burning across central Washington, and voters seeking something to drink with limited dollars in their pockets were starting to think that privatizing liquor maybe wasn't such a great idea, considering it was costing the state a little bit of money to offload some of those liquor stores. Also in August, we lost longtime Como News anchor Kathy Gertson after a very public battle against recurring brain tumors. Katie Sewell spoke with chief weathercaster Steve Poole the day after her passing. They'd worked side by side for 30 years.
The thing I think that is not sort of readily apparent to the viewer is just how much time we spent together when we weren't on the air, because we would go on, our families would go on vacations together, you know, we had our kids at about the same time, and always, you know, talked on the telephone, texting each other. The fact that we had spent so much time together, kind of that crucible of broadcasting, where you have, you know, there's a lot of pressure to do what we do, and it forges you. You know, you grow even closer together as a result of that, I think.
What would you say that you learned about yourself from knowing her so intimately all these years?
That's a good question. I probably that. I'm not as strong as she was, and her strength was always something that I just found so astounding. When this first started, I mean, this has been going on for like 14 years, and when she first found out she got the tumor, that she had a brain tumor, she came into my office, and she had this look on her face, and I said, what's wrong? And she told me what it was, and I mean, that's obviously it's a devastating diagnosis, and it's very scary, and we just kind of hugged each other and just kind of stood there for a while, because at that point she didn't really have a full view of what was going on. But, you know, she had the first operation, and then over the course of that 14 years, I believe it was 9 other operations, either 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And each time it took a little bit out of her. I mean, obviously it would. But what was so amazing to me is her mental strength through that whole process, and how her primary concern seemed to be how were the people around her coping with it as opposed to how she was coping with it. And, you know, you have to kind of ask yourself under those circumstances, you say, you think about what would I do and how would I react? And, you know, I'd like to think I could be as strong as Kathy, but I kind of doubt it.
Do you have a plan of how you're going to move on from here, or at least with the news, daily news broadcast? Are people taking a break? Are you taking a few days off?
Well, you know, no, I'm not taking any time off. I can tell you that yesterday's broadcast was a surreal experience. I mean, we were on we did 4 hours yesterday, and that doesn't count the time, you know, in sort of dealing with this, that doesn't count the time in the morning that I was I was fortunate to be able to, when they knew it was imminent, I got a call from Kathy's husband, and my wife and I were able to go down and spend some time with her before she passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to just hold her hand, and I think I know she knew that I was there. And so throughout the morning, I was pretty much kind of in a state of shock and, you know, trying to process all this. But then you have to go on the air and you do 4 hours of straight of programming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there weren't many emotions, if any, that were hidden. You know, I mean, I had my times when I was crying on the air and all of the above. And it was really tough. So I think to answer your question, I think today I still have all the shows to do, but I'm probably going to just sit.
Yeah.
Drink some tea. Just remember that for a period of 54 years, we had a pretty remarkable human being come through our life here in the Northwest and touched us all in a very unique way.
That's Steve Poole, the Como weathercaster, newsman, remembering his friend and longtime colleague, Kathy Gertzen, who died in August of this year through a long struggle with brain tumors. By September, the campaign for president were in full swing, both campaigns in full swing. The Democratic convention wrapped up the first week of September, with viewers praising Bill Clinton's appearance above most of the others. Certain members of the GOP were publicly criticizing the Romney campaign after his comments about the 47% went public. Here in Washington state, Rob McKenna was trailing Jay Inslee in the polls, and Mayor Mike McGinn was seeking ways to implement the police reforms laid out in a settlement with the Department of Justice. One person brought in to advise Mike McGinn was civil rights attorney Connie Rice from Los Angeles.
The time for fighting is over. We don't have to accept any of the previous fights. We can start fresh. We can use the court's process for Seattle to work through as a family so that what we end up with is a city that has a police force all of its communities can trust, a city where the police feel like the community backs them, and a city that's moving forward together as opposed to fighting. You know, I have to say this. I'm a civil rights lawyer. I'm a litigator. I love litigating. And I'm a very good litigator, and I have to say that I was winning all of my cases, but my clients were losing their lives. And when you're winning your cases, but your clients are losing their lives, you have to figure out how to do things differently, because what that means is that I wasn't solving the problems of the community. I was just doing what I knew how to do best, and I was having a good time at it. But the point was not for me to have a good career. Who cares about my career? What matters is the health of the children in the poorest areas of any city, and all the rural areas too. We have children dying in our rural enclaves where the methamphetamine economy is, and we have children dying in the crack cocaine and heroin economies. As adults, I'm sorry, we can't have cities or rural areas where children don't thrive. The first civil right, the first of all civil rights, is the right to safety. And if we're not making every single kid safe and giving every single kid a chance to thrive and to learn and to bring themselves out of poverty, we're failing.
Did you have a crisis of conscience? Did you wake up one morning and say, waking up suing the police department is not working? Did something particular happen to change your vision?
The biggest epiphany for me that made me realize that even though I was a very successful civil rights litigator, that I was failing the children of Los Angeles was I had started working with gang intervention workers in Jordan Downs Housing Project, one of the predominantly African-American projects in Watts, helping these ex-gangsters try to protect the children from the Crips and the Bloods. Well, one day I had seen something, and it made me ask the question, do the children of Jordan Downs have a choice in joining the local gang? And Fred Williams, the gang intervention expert who was teaching me, he said, Connie, I had a choice. but I want you to see something so that you know what some of these children face. And he put in a beta tape into the VCR, and as I watched it more and more, I just began to get sick because it was the tape of a little 11-year-old girl being gang raped. And the reason she was being gang raped was because her brother, her 12-year-old brother, had told the Grape Street Crips, "No, I don't want to join the gang." And so they gang raped her and put it on tape, and they gave him the tape, and they said, "If you don't join us, the next time she dies." My question for myself at that point was, how could we have let these two children face down these fiends with no one to help them? So I decided that if we had areas of this city where children could be totally terrorized and destroyed this way, then it was my job to change those environments. And it was my job to figure out how to protect those children.
That's civil rights attorney Connie Rice, who's been advising the city of Seattle and the police department as they implement the changes laid out by the Department of Justice. On a much lighter note, this year brought about a regular weekly segment we call the Radio Retrospective, where producer Katie Sewell and I remember the roots of radio and how the Golden Age shaped the media of our modern world. Here's a part of a segment we did on September 20th.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking.
Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
Time for another look back into the golden age of radio, our series Radio Retrospective, where we take a look at what happened in radio as a way maybe of understanding what will happen with radio as it evolves. Katie Sewell, producer of this show, radio fan. You were thinking about the evolution of the Western, huh?
Yeah, I was. Today is the anniversary of when the Six Shooter started. It was a Western starring Jimmy Stewart, or James Stewart, as he went in the credits on that show. And it started on this day in 1953. So I thought it was a good opportunity to look back on how the Western transitioned from kids' entertainment into a serious genre for adults.
Huh.
And The Six Shooter was sort of the end of that transition. But to start, let's go all the way back, shall we, to 1933 and The Lone Ranger, a show that we would not today consider to be a very serious Western, looking back, but you might find it surprising that it actually was considered that at the time. On a totally side note, do you know what he's saying there?
He's saying hi-ho silver.
He's away. Actually saying hi-yo silver.
Hi-yo silver?
Something I found out along the way in researching today, and I thought that was interesting enough to point out.
Hi-yo silver.
Hi-yo silver, I know. And do you know why silver is called silver?
No.
It's because his original sponsor was Silver Cup Bread. But anyway, that's a side note. So anyway, the Lone Ranger, he was a conscientious, humble hero. He never stuck around to be thanked. He was riding his horse Silver, and he was riding with his Native American friend Tonto. And this seems very dated, stereotyped now. But let's not forget that the Lone Ranger was created around a time when it was competing with Westerns that sounded like this.
Yes, folks, it's the new Roy Rogers radio show for the whole family, starring Roy Rogers, King of the Cowboys, and Dale Evans, Queen of the West. And now, here to greet you with a song and a story is Roy Rogers.
From this valley, they say you are going. We will miss your bright eyes and sweet smile.
Well, good evening, folks. Mothers and fathers and all you little buckaroos. Hear that music they're playing? That sure is a fine old song. And it reminds me of a story. Funny thing how a song seems to go together with something that happened to you. The good old Red River Valley.
So Roy Rogers was just one of a lot of different cowboy shows that were going on at the time that had cowboys that were singing ballads and they were telling stories around the campfire. And they had girlfriends and they called people little buckaroos. Things like that. So you can see why against that framework, the Lone Ranger actually seemed rather edgy and more realistic. He was a character that had a dramatic backstory. He wasn't just a, you know, guy sitting around on the farm. And his relationship with Tonto at the time, believe it or not, was also considered more politically correct than how Native Americans were shown before. It's one of the first depictions where the Native is a friend and not an enemy, and somebody who would come to the rescue if the Lone Ranger needed it.
Him right away. We go after him, huh?
No, Tonto.
But we catch him easy.
No, let him go. I want him to lead us to the men higher up.
Oh. You not hurt?
No, not touched. He had his gun right on me, too. But I dropped to one side of the saddle when you came in.
You hear me give bird call, huh?
Yes.
Get plenty good mealy posse. Come back to you.
If you hadn't, I might have been done for.
Of course, considering he was an actor from a different race. It's all relative, isn't it? That's the Lone Ranger on the Radio Retrospective. And I don't know, Little Buckaroos, the fact that silver was named for Silver Cup Bread, that seems to fit right in with our theme, since this segment is all about how the way the media is shaped today was affected by the way it was evolving and growing during the golden age of radio. You can hear that segment every Thursday at 10:40 in 2013. You're listening to Weekday. I'm Steve Scher. We are counting down 2012. Chronologically, bringing you some of the stories of this past year and remembering some of the other issues, the other personalities, the other ideas that we took up with you throughout the year that is ending. The start of October brought about our annual fall pledge drive. The news did not stop during those 2 weeks. Seattle Metro made major changes to the bus system. Seattle Police Department began using Twitter. And the election raged on as candidates were debating. We had a conversation with Sherman Alexie during that time. He was celebrating the 20th anniversary of his writing career with the release of a collection of new and old short stories. And while he was there, the discussion turned to what everyone else was talking about at the time, the two presidential candidates.
You know, I'm trying to figure out when two candidates have been trying to outbore each other. So, you know, they're both so boring.
They're very careful, aren't
they're
they?
They're so boring, you know. And I'm enjoying Romney, who, you know, his entire life has been a moderate, decent fellow, even as he was destroying entire communities. And
he did it moderately and decently.
Yes, decently. And you know, he keeps messing up because he doesn't believe anything he's saying. These are not his politics. This is not how he believes the world works. This is not the way you treat people. And I
think the 47% comment was close to what he believes.
I don't believe that. I think he was raising money, and he was raising money from the people who do believe that.
And so he was talking to them too. Oh, interesting.
Yeah,
that's a very kind interpretation.
I have this theory. He is his better soul is subconsciously self-destructing the evil that will come into power if he wins.
So that's why you see him. I mean, sometimes you see him. We'll see how he looks in the debates. But lately, it seems like he's been sort of shrinking in on himself a bit.
He doesn't want it. I firmly believe he does not want it. I think especially now that he spent quality time with Paul Ryan, you know, hanging out with Voldemort, he's thinking, you know, maybe Harry Potter is where the Black Harry Potter is who we should have as president.
Did you?
That's who Obama is.
It's the Black Harry Potter?
The Black Harry Potter. You know, kind of dorky and, you know.
but he's really not. He is also being very careful in this campaign.
Yeah.
So Harry Potter wasn't going to really use some of those spells he had figured out to stop Voldemort.
Yeah, well, Harry Potter never really let it go. I mean, he never did a death spell, and, you know, I mean, until the end. So Harry Potter could have been killing, you know, things left and right. I don't even remember what those things are called. So
Obama's drone strikes are Harry Potter's magic spells.
Exactly.
To carry the metaphor.
You know, I was reading the New York Times book review yesterday and talking about what we liberals know, that Obama actually, I mean, he was comparing it, the review was comparing Obama to Richard Nixon, and you realize that Obama has only been as liberal as Richard Nixon was.
They're comparing him to Richard Nixon in terms of his economic policies?
Yes, check it out. I didn't even put it all together as one, the new stuff Nixon was doing. I mean, Nixon had a national health care program.
Yeah.
Nixon was talking about minimum incomes. Nixon was talking about more regulation of the insurance industry.
Wage and price freeze.
Exactly. Nixon was hanging out with Chinese folks. You know, I mean, Nixon was, you know, revamping and reevaluating and revisioning international policy.
Barack Milhouse Obama.
Exactly. So just stay away from the cassette tapes, Obama. Just stay away.
Sherman Alexie, considering what we learned just last week from Mitt Romney's son, that Mitt Romney didn't really want the presidency, it's Sherman seems to once again not just had his finger on the pulse, but been ahead of the curve in interpreting what was happening, perhaps. While the nation and the electorate was consumed by the election and recovering from Hurricane Sandy, Katie Sewell took a little time out to have a conversation with author Will Schwalbe. He wrote the book, The End of Your Life Book Club. It documents the impromptu book club he started with his mom while she was undergoing chemo for a life-threatening form of pancreatic cancer.
I mean, I never felt we shouldn't be talking about books because we always enjoyed it so much. And mom was so alive when she was reading and talking about books. And it did lead to so many other conversations. But there was one moment a couple months before she died where I had this idea, and I think it may have come from the movies, that I should have this big talk with her. I should sit down and I should tell her what a wonderful mother she was and everything she'd done for me and how grateful I was. And I kept thinking, when is the right moment for the big talk? When is the right moment for the big talk? And one day was over and I was sure it was the right moment for the big talk and I just couldn't do it. And I meant to say at that moment, Mom, I just wanted to tell you I love you. But something totally different came out of my mouth and I wound up saying, I'm proud of you. And that's all I said. And it's kind of a weird thing for a child to say to a parent, but I'm really, really glad I said it.
How did she take it?
She, I think, was really, really pleased with that. And in many ways, it reflected the fact that our relationship had morphed over so many years from parent-child to still parent-child, but something else too. A relationship where she wasn't the only one who could be proud of me. I could be proud of her too.
This is a little bit of a sidestep, but who was David Rode to your mother? Can you remind us who he was?
Yeah.
And also what, how he's involved in your story?
So Mom, after her years as a refugee advocate traveling all over the world, I mean, she was in East Timor and Bosnia and Liberia, but she was also very frequently in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And while there, she met an extraordinary woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree, who had a phenomenal collection of 38,000 books on Soviet, I'm sorry, on Afghan history after the Soviet invasion. And so Mom had met Nancy, and Nancy had a dream of building a library in Kabul. And Mom helped create a U.S. foundation to make this dream come true. And she roped into it a fellow named David Rode, a really terrific New York Times reporter. And in the midst of this whole thing, while he was researching a book, he was seized by the Taliban. And so over the course of my book, I describe Mom's just panic and despair at the fact that this young man, who she thought was so terrific, this great force for good in the world, this amazing New York Times reporter, was in this horrible place. He was a captive of the Taliban.
But, and you also talk a little bit about how, sort of off of Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, that for you, you had a little bit of magical thinking when it came to David Rode.
I did. Mom was so upset about David and so worried about him that I thought, if by any way, chance, shape, or hope David Rode came out of that situation alive, it would give Mom the kind of peace that she really needed before she left the earth, whenever that was. And through a complete and total miracle, David managed to escape the Taliban and make it back safely. And in fact, Mom met up with him about a week after he came back at the wedding of a child of one of her oldest friends. And it gave her an incredible sense of peace. It was like she and I had attached to David Rode's freedom a kind of equation that if he was able to get out, then she would feel sort of all right about the world as she was leaving it.
Will Schwalbe wrote The End of Your Life Book Club. We talked to him in October. In November, President Barack Obama was reelected. So were many congressional Republicans, leaving little change to the balance of power. In Washington state, voters legalized same-sex marriage, marijuana, charter schools. Just when we thought the election was over, Tim Burgess announced he was running for mayor of Seattle, giving us a glimpse of the upcoming mayor's race in 2013. In November, we also met local photographer Matika Wilbur. She's begun a project called 562. She's setting out across the country to photograph members of all the Native American tribes.
I had a dream with my grandmother, Laura, who passed on when I was about 13 years old. And it's the only dream I've ever actually had with her. And she said, "What are you doing photographing these Indians when you haven't even photographed your own? You know, go home and photograph your people." And so I did. And that's when We Are One People was born. And then from that.
One of the first exhibits you did, one of the first portfolios you did, yeah.
Yeah. And, which was shown at the Seattle Art Museum and the Royal British Columbia Museum. But I didn't initially aspire to be a documentary photographer of Indian people. It just sort of picked me.
And picked you.
Yeah.
That's what dreams will do.
Yeah.
All right. So what do you want it to look like at the end? What's your vision for the entire catalog?
Well, I really would like to create a dynamic portrait of contemporary Native people in Indian country, you know, from the Pawnee entrepreneur who owns a restaurant who's selling Indian tacos to the politician who's lobbying for our, you know, sovereignty, the youth who are experiencing cultural duality, the elders, the culture bearers, and really sort of bring to the forefront, you know, this is who we are now, and this is how we've evolved as a people.
Why is that important today? Why is that necessary, do you think?
I think it's necessary that people realize that we survived. You know, and I think the stereotype that I've experienced quite often is that we didn't, or that we're not here anymore. Not so much in the Northwest, because, you know, there's a very dynamic exchange happening here. But in other places, for instance, like when I was in Germany and people would ask to touch my hair or something.
Really?
Because they'd want to be, you know, they've always wanted to be blessed by an Indian princess, that type of thing. So I feel like, in a way, it's necessary.
So that noble savage notion running strong in some places still.
The diminishing race.
Yeah. So we talked to Tim Egan about Edward Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
And Egan's argument was, because he wrote a book about Edward Curtis.
Mm-hmm.
Egan's argument was that the rap on Curtis was that he was capturing Indians as museum pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But Egan's argument about Curtis and about what Curtis said was that he was getting a snapshot in time to establish an image and a sense of Native people 100 years. This was 100 years ago. Not that they were vanishing or diminishing, but that here's where they were today. But you disagree with that somewhat. You see Curtis in a different light.
I wouldn't say that I disagree. I would say that I would reference a quote that he said, that Curtis said right after he was commissioned by J.P. Morgan in 1906, where he said, you know, we must capture the diminishing race at once before all is lost. And so I think if that is the perspective, that I have to go out and I have to photograph all of these people before they're all gone, then that's a different sort of conception than my standpoint.
Matika Wilbur is out photographing all the Native American tribes in a photographic project she's calling 562. In November, the great Taj Mahal gave us a history of American music in 3 minutes.
The best thing that happened to music recently was rap. And like bebop, you know, like blues, like jazz, those are all outlaw musics. Even gospel was an outlaw music, you know.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, because the designer of gospel is one Thomas A. Dorsey, who used to be known as Georgia Tom, the blues singer. And so he and people like Sister Rosetta Thorpe, who was really a gospel, you know, a disseminator of gospel all over the place. And she worked back and forth with like Andy Kirk and Lucky Millinder's band. And, you know, I mean, she, I don't know if you've ever spent any time looking at her on YouTube. Oh, seriously.
Look her up.
Oh, my God. It's like that she was. You talk about somebody that Elvis Presley was excited by. Everybody talks about, you know, Arthur Big Boy Crudup, but he and lots of the early rockers were nuts about Rosetta Tharpe. Rosetta Tharpe was a serious guitar player. She started out playing like a national duolian kill on it, and she. But you know, this people that were doing that, you know, the religious community was like, they're not having no blues notes in no Christian music, and it took a while. Now we're looking back, and nobody thinks of it. People don't think of blues as being a radical music, you know. And then early rap. I mean, you know, now it's like it's already happened. But when it was coming down the pike. It, to me, it was like bebop. It was radical, you know, and it shook people up. And, you know, it was a point of view. I mean, if you really see where these kids were, is that who helped them get the instruments? Nobody. Was there, when they shut down all the music in the community? The only way they could learn the music was off of the records that they heard. So, you know, here you got the music which is happening in its natural form, or as natural as it can be, and then it gets recorded, and then from the recordings it comes into the people, and then these kids are younger and they hear that, and then that's what they go back to. They don't go back to traditional rhythms or anything that's structured like that. Plus, aside from that, was that by that time everybody was into like Luther Vandross, and you know Luther had the women mesmerized, and the young kids coming up, they wanted something hard. That's why Walk This Way got up in there.
Taj Mahal. The news this month has been a mix of emotional highs and lows. The recent shooting. The Connecticut Elementary School turned the nation's conversation away from the fiscal cliff for a little bit and to the issue again of gun control, as it ran a theme that ran through the year, as you've heard, and also to improving the mental health system. At the start of this month, though, marijuana and same-sex marriage became officially legal, and hundreds of couples lined up at city halls around the state to get their marriage licenses and to get hitched. We went downtown to the King County building, where couples were waiting to apply for their marriage licenses.
John Hines.
Jeff Fickus. Marriage is a big deal, no matter your orientation. It's a big deal. Did you talk about it? Just the marriage, not the political act, but the idea of being married?
Yeah, we have. And we've kind of, I think, been through enough kind of, I want to say, ups and downs in the relationship. Things that have gone well, things that have gone wrong, good choices, bad choices, and it felt like this was the right choice.
Yeah, it's one of those things where the reality of it hasn't actually hit me completely. Just talking to friends at work at Starbucks and having them saying, "Oh, it's huge." It's like, "Oh yeah, this is huge." Like just getting here has been so huge and exhausting for me. But actually doing it, I didn't actually think about the next step.
When are you going to get married?
On Sunday, here.
Yeah, we're one of the 140 here on Sunday afternoon.
Will family and friends be here?
Our friends will be here. My family lives across the country, so them getting here in such a short period of time was going to be too much of a hardship. So we're planning on doing something a little bit later in September when we can gather the larger tribe together.
But they're with you. They're excited.
Yeah, they're totally excited.
Your family, too?
No, they don't support it at all. But we are still family. So it's something that I've learned to just realize I can't change them any more than they can change me.
Does the idea of you being married give them something to relate to, something in common that lets them maybe come a few steps closer?
Perhaps. That's what I'm hoping for, is that when they realize that I've been through the relationship part and been through the marriage, and that I'm really standing on my own and saying, this is me, and I love Jeff, and I'm not going to not get married to make anybody happy. I'm going to get married to make myself happy.
Kids? Kids in the future?
We have a dog. We've got Pete.
I'm really looking forward to also is that a lot of the folks that we've invited to the ceremony on Sunday have kids. And these are the kids that are in our lives pretty regularly. And so I think it's pretty special that this occasion, this day, this moment is going to be shared with those kids. And they may never know that there was anything any different.
Just a taste of the scene outside the King County building the night King County and the rest of Washington State started issuing marriage licenses to all of the citizens. You know, I want to take a moment to thank all the folks who make this show possible in one form or another. I can't thank all the folks because it's so many people. But, you know, the governor, the mayor, the attorney general, the King County executive, they take time to come in once a month to answer our questions. Also, Nancy Pearl, Michael Fagan, Marty Wingate, Greg Rayburn, Willie Galloway, Vaughn Palmer, Robert Horton, Todd Bishop, Michael Parks, John Talton, Roger Ferris, Sarah Dickerman, Nick Bond, Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. They come in every week to help us put this show on. Put on by Amin Al-Sadi, Leslie McClurg, Brian Buckley was with us, our interns Alexander Garrettin and Daniel Anthony Goodwin. Also, Doug Patterson, Eamon Nordquist, John Sullivan in the ops department helped bring our live music to you. All the folks behind the mics who make KUOW a great institution. And most of all, of course, you, not just as listeners, which I very much appreciate as listeners, but also as contributors. This year, we began doing a sound of the day, and you sent in great sounds that tell us something about your days that we can share. Here's a compilation of just some of the sounds we heard from you this year.
Thank you.
Just some of the great sounds you sent to us this year. Get a sense of what your day sounds like. We appreciate you making us part of the sound of your day. And Dornfeld helped produce a lot of our program this year, early in the year. Marcy Silman has been a regular contributor to this show and steps in as the backup host when I step away, as does Katie Sewell. Katie Sewell is also the producer of this show, along with Jason Pagano, who we threw right into the thick of it as the producer of this show this year as well. Most of all, I thank you for being a part of this show, and I thank Andy Hurst for being the engineer of this show for much of the year. And next year, we're gonna make it even harder for the person who engineers the show. And Andy, he's going to have to help us do the show a little bit more as well. So thanks for listening. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Happy New Year.